Hello, and welcome to Citizen Kane Minute, the show that examines the greatest film of all time, 5 minutes at a time. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and join me to discuss minutes 110 to 115 of Citizen Kane is writer and actress Greer Sinclair. Hi, Greer.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
You are our first actor on the show.
Well, that's an honor.
So I'm interested in, like, seeing, you know, your point of view about how you engage with this movie. Again, we're going to be talking about minutes 110 to 115. It's going to start with Charlie in the middle of his rampage in Susan's bedroom, and it's going to end in the middle of this pan across Xanadu. But before we get to all that, I said, Greer, I have to ask you, when did you first see Citizen Kane?
So Citizen Kane is, I have an interesting experience with that. I probably saw it when I was about 7 or 8 years old. And it's one of those movies that has been so deeply embedded in my subconscious because I saw it at such an early age. For a long time, I wasn't really sure if I had dreamed it. Like, I never really had the response that most people have approaching the film of, like, this is the greatest film ever made and you should approach it with this perspective. So for me, I saw it at a very early age. And I came across it the way that I was exposed to a lot of other classic films from that period, which was my parents were both like film purists. Like, they were straight out of Cahiers du Cinéma in that they didn't want my sister and I to watch anything that they considered not a great film. And so on the... It's true. So on the weekends, they would load my sister and I into the car and we would take a drive out to the valley and we'd go to this little off-the-way video store called Eddie Brandt's Saturday Matinee. And for those of you who are not familiar with it, Eddie Brandt's has been a major touchstone for a few decades for people that before streaming was a thing and before even DVDs were a thing, oftentimes there would be no way to track down these films unless you were completely obsessed. And so I just remember walking into this video store and just being greeted by thousands and thousands and thousands of these copies of, like, bootleg VHS tapes. And I would walk out with, like, an armful of these movies, just feeling like I had the whole world in my hands. And I guess this is also, like, a call to arms for everyone to please support your local video stores. And a shout out to Eddie Brandt's Saturday Matinee. I really hope they're reopening their doors soon.
That is amazing. I mean, how old was your sister? Was she older or younger than you?
My sister is 2 years younger than I am, and her name's Greta. So I guess our destiny was sort of, you know, predetermined for us. But I remember I was allowed to pick out any film I wanted as long as it wasn't contemporary. And so when I came across Citizen Kane, my approach to it was, and I don't know if this is an indication of maybe how sheltered or naive I was growing up, but I didn't think that it was an old movie. I thought it was a contemporary adult film. I thought it was a film made for adults, and that as a child, I was being allowed to sort of, like, peek behind the curtain of what adulthood would be like. So that was my first exposure to the film.
That's remarkable. I mean, that's when you're a kid, that's what you want. You want those peeks into adulthood.
Absolutely.
It's so exciting. Do you remember what your reaction was to it? I mean, you said it's so adult and it deals with so many issues of regret and things that as a kid, you're just not, you have no idea about at that point.
Right. I remember feeling that there was a very profound mystery at the heart of the film. And I remember watching it and feeling like there is content and there are themes in this film that I don't understand yet, but I'll understand it when I'm older. And I remember feeling haunted by the film and thinking that I would revisit it as an adult. And, you know, I had this anticipation of being, you know, forever perplexed and fascinated by it. And it's definitely proven to be the case.
You were thinking about themes at 8 years old?
Well, I don't know if I put it explicitly that way, but in a way, like, I think going to Eddie Brandt's and, you know, other video stores at the time was really my most meaningful film education. And, you know, I went on to study film with some wonderful writers and professors of film, but I still think that just going there and coming out with, you know, handfuls of these VHS tapes was the most profound introduction I had.
That's amazing. I got to tell you, when I was 8 years old, my reviews of movies were like, Chewbacca's cool. Like that was what I was thinking at 8 years old. I was not contemplating themes of films, for Pete's sake. That's just amazing. So I do want to, as you know, we said, you're our first actor here on the show. And so this is a question I get to ask you that I haven't had a chance to ask anybody else. As you watch Citizen Kane, first of all, I want to ask, is it something that you return to? Have you watched it multiple times across your life? And if you have, like, is from an actor's point of view, what performances really stand out to you? Are there some that you're just like, wow, that just as a fellow actor, you really honed in on?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think with all great films, and maybe with Citizen Kane in particular, because it does deal with like these questions of age and mortality and legacy, I find that it becomes more meaningful when I review it and when I watch it. And I think that's true of the best movies, is that they really change with our perspective. And as we live our lives and come back to them, our understanding and our involvement and dialogue with the film deepens. And so I can definitely say I think I appreciate it more now, understanding it from a more formal, you know, point of view. Mm-hmm. But I think the initial sort of shock of like how mysterious and deep it was really resonated with me at the time. And as far as great performances in the film, one of the things I want to talk about today as an actor is how Citizen Kane came to be out of the Mercury Theater on Air, which was, as you know, Orson Welles' collective of actors, which did radio broadcasts in the late 1930s. And a lot of the actors that appear in Citizen Kane, such as Agnes Moorehead and Joseph Cotten, were players in the Mercury Theater on Air. So I think for me, and in an additional, like, it wasn't enough that I was like the weird kid at the video store. But in addition to that, I was a huge fan of the Mercury Theater before I saw Citizen Kane. So for me, I sort of had probably what audiences, a similar experience as audiences had had in 1941 when the film came out, which was I was familiar with the actors and their performance style based on their performances in radio drama, but I'd never seen them on film. And in 1941, neither had audiences. This was the first film of Agnes Moorehead. So I think for me, I was like, wow, that's what she looks like, you know? And I was really, I think part of the reason, it's sort of like that transition out of like silence to talkies. I think with Agnes Moorehead in particular, you know, she's sort of exactly what you would hope she would be hearing her voice. So I was delighted. And I love Agnes Moorehead. I'm a huge fan of hers in Dark Passage and the original Sorry Wrong Number radio play, for those who know it, which was later made into a film with Barbara Stanwyck. But I think Joseph Cotten is probably my greatest, he's my favorite in the film.
I just saw Citizen Kane in the theater again when they're part of the Fathom Events thing. And I gotta say, even though I've seen this movie a couple of many dozens of times at this point, I started getting a little, I don't tear up at movies. I just kind of don't, but I started to get emotional watching that scene with Agnes Moorehead. Mm-hmm. And she does so much with so little. Mm-hmm. I mean, she only has that one scene. Right. And she only has what, probably about a dozen lines, but mm-hmm. there's something about her quiet dignity of that, how much this is hurting her to get rid of her son, because she's got to get him away from this awful husband. And I really was like, wow, how is she doing this? I mean, mm-hmm. there's just something about the timbre of her voice and her face. I mean, of course, that's what acting is, would be your face. I mean, for God's sake, so the obvious statement. But it's amazing to think how much she looms over the film, considering she has that, what, 3 minutes, 4 minutes of screen time, and that's
absolutely,
it?
Absolutely. And I think it's also like, it's kind of a lost art in this day and age, but I think that that's also a tribute to the idea of having a consistent group of actors that would work together routinely. And the idea of, like, by the time they made Citizen Kane, Agnes Moorehead was very familiar with Orson Welles, both writing style as well as directing style. And so I think it was a just totally organic transition for them into film. And I think that's why it works so well.
Were you familiar with, you were familiar with the Mercury Theater stuff before you had seen Citizen Kane? Did you listen to that stuff as a kid?
Yes, I did. And so I'm a little bit, I don't know if like traumatized is the word, but I really thought I grew up in the 1940s. I think I sort of knew that it wasn't contemporary. Like, I was getting ads for, like, you know, Lucky Strike cigarettes.
I wore bonds. All right.
Exactly.
I don't know what a war bond is, but right. Okay.
None of the kids at school knew what I was talking about. But yeah, I think listening to those radio shows, it's so vivid, you know, when you're listening to it. And, you know, I was really seduced by the power of Orson Welles to, like, create these visual scenes in my head just through the power of his writing and the performances that he would elicit through his actors.
Oh, I absolutely fell in love with that stuff. When I worked at a video store, we actually had a laser disc. Remember that format? A laser disc of Mercury Theater performances. Now, of course, you would say, why would you put that on a laser disc? Because there's no visuals.
Right.
Why didn't you just put it out as a CD? I don't know. It's called Theater of the Imagination. I still have it.
Cool.
It's sitting here on my bookshelf 5 feet away from me. I can't play it because I don't have a laser disc player. Mm-hmm. But I went, at the time, I did have one. And one of the, it pulls like their version of Dracula and just little selections. But it ends, the disc ends with this bit called, "Ladies and gentlemen, there's a full moon out tonight."
Ooh,
and it's all about Orson Welles just talking to the audience and describing what it's like to be in New York and looking out the window and seeing a full moon. And it is
so gorgeous,
incredibly
so
charming.
Gorgeous. Yeah.
It's like, you're just like, this is this really erudite, interesting, funny guy, but just communing with people that can't see what he's talking about. But man, he paints such a picture. You hear the other Mercury Theater's members kind of chuckling in the background, and it's, you just want to be there. It sounds so wonderfully exciting. So, you know, you were mentioning that, you know, you listened to the Mercury Theater stuff as a kid, and I don't know if you have much reason to watch kids movies nowadays or stuff aimed at kids, but I think that the way they make kids films nowadays, I think that producers think that when it's a kids movie, everything has to be explained because they're kids and they're dumb. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I have found growing up, kids need less explanation than adults because kids accept things. Okay. Yeah. The world's black and white. Okay, fine. You know, they whatever gaps kids have in their brain, they fill it with their imagination.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it's so important, like, for development too, to have that time to imagine. And I think kids are more comfortable with ambiguity.
Yeah. I've mentioned this on previous episodes. We had a local station in my area in Philadelphia. It was called Channel 48, and they ran Abbott and Costello movies on Sundays. And I fell in love with Abbott and Costello, even though the humor is, you know, woefully out of date. These are 40s movies, and I'm watching them in the 70s, and there's references to, you know, Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Wendell Willkie and Bing Crosby. And as a kid, you just, if you don't get the reference, you just kind of paper over it and you move on.
Right.
You know, so it's kind of amazing. I feel like it's amazing, but it's also not, that you were able to watch Citizen Kane at 8 years old and take it in. But of course, as a kid, you're wrapped up by the story, and the rest of it, it's okay. You just move on.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I also think, I don't know that this point is, you know, necessarily made very often in regards to the film or in regards to Orson Welles, but I feel that there is such a strong, deep rooted sense of playfulness in Orson Welles that totally makes sense to kids. You know, like, he's such the magician, and you understand, like, you just, on like an intuitive level, I think it totally makes sense.
That was one of the things that I really keyed in with him when I first watched Kane, and then I realized, oh, this guy's got other movies to watch, was that playfulness, that kind of impish spirit, which travels across most of his films and even in his appearances in other people's work.
Oh, you know,
there's just that kind of, he's in the Muppet movie for Pete's sake. You know? I mean, he's just like, and when he would appear on Johnny Carson, and we've talked about in previous episodes, he would come on to Johnny Carson, not to promote anything. He would just come on just to tell stories. And Johnny Carson would just sit there in rapt attention as Orson Welles is telling some story about hanging out with like Lindbergh or something. And that's the life force. So yeah, he does have that kind of kid-like energy to him, even though, you know, he's got this weight on him as the great, you know, the maker of the greatest film of all time. Speaking of that, I want to ask you, what other, you know, do you think Citizen Kane belongs in that pantheon? And what other films in your mind would you put alongside it as like some of the greatest film achievements ever?
Well, I was actually, I was thinking about this question in anticipation of answering it. And I think what's important with the dialogue surrounding Citizen Kane is like, it really so much like in the, I think, public mind, like exists in a league of its own. Like other films are discussed as being the greatest films of all time, you know, Vertigo and et cetera. But Citizen Kane is like, really, it's just always sort of isolated in a way. And always sort of regarded almost like, you know, nothing was like it before or since. And what I think is interesting is like in that period out of the late 1930s and into the 1940s, there were a number of films that maybe stylistically or in the, you know, technical achievements of the film weren't as great. But I think thematically, there are a few other films that you can put alongside Citizen Kane, and they really inform each other beautifully. And so to that end, I think that, you know, what I would call this genre is it's kind of a gothic Americana. Because one of the questions also surrounding Citizen Kane is like, is it a film noir or not? You know, can it be considered a film noir? And I think there are elements of film noir in Citizen Kane, and especially visually, you know, the tropes of like the high contrast, the dark shadows, the like massive claustrophobic environments. But I would really describe it as a gothic Americana film that's very particular to a certain period of American history that has to do with like the disillusionment around the time America entered the Second World War. And in that gothic Americana, there was like, it was really thematically, I think, about the death of American innocence. And a lot of these films sort of look back at small town, usually rural American life with like this deep sense of like loss and nostalgia. And I think that's definitely something that permeates the heart of Citizen Kane. I mean, that's like the essence of Rosebud. It's like this symbol of like this lost innocence. And so this is a, you know, long answer to your question. But the other films that I would put in category alongside Citizen Kane for those reasons. First on my list is a film called King's Row from 1942.
Ronald Reagan, right?
That's what it's mostly known as. Absolutely. And on a short list, I think that's considered among Reagan's greatest performances. It was definitely his favorite of his performances. And it's directed by Sam Wood, who directed Goodbye, Mr. Chips and Pride of the Yankees, among other things. And it's basically a melodrama about this small town in America and how industrialization wreaks havoc on the landscape and also like the psyche of the inhabitants of this small town. And it's very gothic. For those of you who are familiar with this, Ronald Reagan wrote an autobiography in the 60s called Where's the Rest of Me? And that line is taken from King's Row. And if I may, I have a spoiler for the film. In the film, Ronald Reagan plays this incredibly good-looking, charismatic, you know, man about town. And he is wounded and has to have his legs amputated. And in the scene, he wakes up in the bed after the operation and he looks down at his Adonis-like body and he says, "Where's the rest of me?" And I just think that's such, like, I don't think it gets any more American gothic than Ronald Reagan asking, "Where's the rest of his body?"
Seriously. Wow.
I mean, it's like such a metaphor. And I also just, you know, symbolically, I think that like films at that time were trying to address like this very fresh trauma of war, where, you know, the world is not what it was. The effects of industrialization have changed everything. And so that does, I think, sort of in a, you know, a few years later, become something that very much affects the development of film noir. But I think there's a little window of like these Gothic Americana films that I would definitely put Citizen Kane alongside. The next one in that vein is the film that Wells made after this, which is The Magnificent Ambersons.
Oh, man.
Which is also interestingly from 1942. So both King's Row and Magnificent Ambersons came out in 42. You know, this is very much wartime. And I think, honestly, I prefer Magnificent Ambersons to Citizen Kane, but we'll never really see the film that Orson Welles intended. So I guess we sort of have to love the Frankenstein monster that it exists.
Yeah, I said it's just, it's amazing how good that film is, even after you know that the ending was hacked and a happy ending was slapped on the end of it. It's, and the movie's still that good.
And I just wanted to also bring up one interesting note about The Magnificent Ambersons. It includes a score by Bernard Herrmann, who also did the score for Citizen Kane. And I learned recently that Citizen Kane was the first film that Bernard Herrmann ever scored.
Is it really?
Which, right? I was blown away. I mean, talk about like not only the greatest film, you know, ever made, but to have that be Orson Welles' first film, Agnes Moorehead's first film, and Bernard Herrmann's first film is completely astonishing. But I think that's also a tribute to the Mercury Theater, because Bernard Herrmann was the composer for the Mercury Theater. And when Orson Welles was given his contract by RKO after the success of War of the Worlds, the broadcast, he brought Bernard Herrmann with him to Hollywood.
That's, I did not know that. I didn't think to look up Bernard Herrmann's credits before this. That is astonishing.
And Bernard Herrmann, like, his name actually doesn't appear on Magnificent Ambersons because the film was so edited by RKO. I think like half of Herman's score was like redone and edited so severely that Bernard Herrmann demanded that his name be taken off the film. But I mean, you just think like, you know, Bernard Herrmann, you know, followed his work with Orson Welles by working with Alfred Hitchcock. And, you know, those are his, some of his best known compositions. And I just, I was so astonished. I mean, imagine your first film score is, you know, Citizen Kane, start at the top.
Yeah, I like this Gothic Americana idea. I've never really heard it put that way.
Thank you. Yes.
I'm making you think of what other movies would I fit into that category now.
Well, I mean, I think I'm formally presenting this idea here on this podcast today. So, you know, in any Wikipedia articles that result, I'm coining this phrase for this genre. I mean, it also with Gothic Americana, like it's it's coming from a literary tradition, and the idea of the Gothic is like a much older idea. You know, the first Gothic novel was written in 1746 by Horace Walpole, and it followed a little later in America, but it really is like that transition from sort of this like American pastoral idyllic to like something much darker. And it does seem like the precursor to film noir to me. So I think in that, you know, period in the 30s and 40s, that's like a narrow window, but I would stake a claim for that.
You know, now that we're talking about a film that I feel like fits that would be Hitchcock's Shadow of a Doubt.
Absolutely.
With Joseph Cotton. Because that movie is like a Norman Rockwell painting with a murderer in it.
That's precisely. Really what that movie is. Exactly. And like some of the qualities of the Gothic novel, which, you know, bleed over into, you know, what I'm calling, you know, Gothic Americana, is like that the psychological richness of it. And, you know, it's not just sort of like presentational, like nothing is what it seems in the Gothic. And I think that's so beautifully and so creepily embodied by Joseph Cotton in that film. Like it's a very, very psychologically disturbing film.
Oh yeah, he was. Like I said, when I went and saw it a week ago at the Fathom events, I took my fiance, and she had not seen Citizen Kane for decades. She saw it once as like a teenager, and then she had not seen it again. And she walked out of it, and she said, "Boy, that I really love that Joseph Cotten." I was like, "Yeah, he's just kind so of great. Effortlessly so great. Charming, that guy."
Mm-hmm. And it's such an interesting twist because he's so likable, and like you just see his face, and you immediately trust him. That mm-hmm. to play the opposite of that is so uncanny, and I think it's really, I think that's one of the, you know, such an important message in the Gothic is, you know, everything is to be questioned, and you know, that idea of like the double, like, is he good? Is he bad? Very Freudian. Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely. I know that you are particularly interested in film noir. That's something that you really, really enjoy. I mean, was film, how old were you when you started picking up on that? When you, do you feel like you were able to say, oh, this is this style of film that I'm really enjoying? I mean, you said you were watching Citizen Kane at 8. Were you watching film noir around the same time, or did you, it took you a little longer to get to that kind of stuff?
Well, similarly, just like I wasn't, no one told me before I saw Citizen Kane that it was the greatest movie ever made. And similarly, similarly with film noir, no one told me it was a film noir. Like, and I think that that's kind of the beauty of like having encountered these films, like not necessarily in like an academic setting. It's like they weren't branded for me. Mm. And so I gravitated to them for, you know, reasons I should probably, you know, work out with a psychologist. but I remember being, I was very drawn to film noir as I, you know it now today. And I remember around the time, you know, that I got Citizen Kane from Eddie Brandt's Saturday Matinee, I was watching a movie and they had a trailer for The Maltese Falcon. Mm. And I remember being in my room by myself watching the trailer and I was so scared and I didn't even know why. And it's not because there's anything necessarily frightening in The Maltese Falcon, but I just had the feeling of like this deep, brooding, very adult theme in it and in this like the mystery of it. And I think Mary Astor's character, like I'd never seen really like such a duplicitous female character that I liked so much. And so I was definitely very drawn to it. And I do also sort of remembering that I just thought the female characters in film noir films were so much more interesting than any of the other films I was seeing. And I think it's because they're usually so much more three-dimensional and complicated.
Yeah. It's do you have a couple of particular favorite film noir? Just because before we get to these minutes, I'm sort of curious. Do you have film noirs that you go back and watch and that you particularly really love?
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, some of them I love so much that I've like sort of lived through them in one way or another. I really love one of the other, you know, films that I was going to mention as one that's as great, if not better, than Citizen Kane is Billy Wilder's Ace in the Hole from 1951.
Man. Yeah.
I really love that. I think Laura, the Otto Preminger film, was, I've watched that movie so many times and I really remember loving it as a kid. I think I wanted to be Jean Tierney. I wanted to be Laura in the movie. I love that one. So, I mean, the list goes on and on. I could talk about film noir forever. So it just depends how much time we have.
I can have as much time as you need, girl.
Wow. Thank you. It's such an honor. Really, it's, I mean, Night of the Hunter, certainly another favorite. And I think that's also sort of, you know, in that Gothic Americana category.
Oh yeah. Movies like a dark children's book.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the visuals and like that American pastoral, like, you know, twisted in that way is so interesting. For film noir, Detour.
I'm sure. Okay.
1945. I mean, that just, I've never gotten over.
Is that, is that Edgar Ulmer?
Yes, it is.
Okay, right. Okay.
Yes, it is.
Wow. And that's a broad range where you've got Orson Welles and then Edgar Ulmer on there. But in, when you think about it, they had a lot of similarities. You know, post-Kane, mm-hmm. poor Welles was having to patch together his movies out of spit and baling wire because he couldn't get any money to mm-hmm. make his movies, and so did Edgar Ulmer, really. So.
Oh, yeah, and I'm just reminded, too, another film that I wanted to bring up in dialogue with Citizen Kane is The Bad and the Beautiful. the Vincent Minnelli film from 1952, because I was thinking there, I think, you know, as the question of like, is Citizen Kane film noir or not, you know, persists to this day. And I think there's no doubt that it's been very influential on film noir, and the way that, you know, The Bad and the Beautiful is structured with the flashback, and the flashback told from multiple point of view, I think is a direct hat tip to Citizen Kane. And there's one other movie I wanted to talk about really quick. So this is not a film noir, but I don't know if you're familiar with a 1971 essay by Pauline Kael in which she discusses the making of Citizen Kane.
Sure, yeah.
Raising Kane.
Raising Kane, yeah.
Exactly. I mean, a very controversial piece of writing. And I'm sorry to Peter Bogdanovich if he's listening to this.
I don't think we have to worry about that group.
Well, okay. I don't know. You know, he's like Orson Welles' right-hand man. I'm sure he's got Google Alert, you know. But what I think is interesting is, you know, in that essay, Pauline Kael talks about this movie, this pre-code film from 1933 called The Power and the Glory, which is a film that's like virtually impossible to find. And I don't think anyone's really seen it, but it stars Spencer Tracy as a hugely successful railroad tycoon. And the film starts with a funeral, and we're hearing the legacy of this man who's just died. And then the whole film is told in a flashback from his best friend's point of view.
Huh.
And in the essay, she makes the argument that The Power and the Glory was a huge influence on the structure of Citizen Kane for Herman Mankiewicz and Orson Welles. And if you watch the film, it's a very provocative idea.
I think I've heard of it. I love Spencer Tracy. I've certainly never seen that one. The title sounds a little familiar, but is it available now? How did you see it?
I wish I could say I got it at Eddie Brand's. I think it is, if you look in the right places, wink, wink, I think it is available for streaming, in some dark alley. I'll meet you out back in 3 hours. Okay. But it's really, I think Orson Welles, you know, buried the movie, because when you do watch it side to side, it's just interesting, like with the reputation that Citizen Kane has today, it's interesting to consider that it doesn't exist as like this freak demonstration of perfection, you know, and that everything is like influenced by everything else. And, you know, I know like Mankiewicz had this idea of the screenplay that he wanted to write about a public figure. And like, there's so much, you know, varying accounts of how that screenplay came to be. But for any fans of Citizen Kane, I would definitely recommend seeking out The Power and the Glory as a potential influence and just an interesting double feature. And King's Row, I would say King's Row and The Power and the Glory would be the two that I would seek out if you're a Citizen Kane aficionado, obsessor.
I am, and I have not seen. I mean, I've not seen either one of those movies. I mean, I was more familiar with King's Row's existence, but man, that sounds, Power and the Glory sounds fascinating, because I just love Spencer Tracy. I've seen every movie I could get my hands on, so that sounds fascinating. Wow, I got to write that down. Check that out. Let's talk about these minutes here. This is the penultimate 5 minutes of the movie. As I said, they're going to start at 110 and they're going to end at 115. They open with Charlie doing the rampage, and right at the moment these minutes start, he drags his hand along the shelf and knocks a bunch of perfume bottles over and some spritzers or whatever other stuff Susan's got. And then we see right in the foreground is, of course, the snow globe, which we saw, if you were paying super attention, you were like a nerd like me, you know, obsessing over these 5 minutes, you saw in the earlier scene with Susan, you see it in the apartment. But also, the thing that your eye tends to go to, because once you know the reality of it, is that Welles, for real, cut his hand on the glass. He was so out of control that he cut his hand along the side and apparently gashed it pretty deep. And you see him quickly pull his left hand out of camera frame. And he pulls it out and he tucks it behind his jacket and he keeps it there through the remainder of the shot. And it was, he said in an interview later, that was my instinct because you didn't want to ruin the take. And then of course you realize, well, it wouldn't have ruined the take. It would have actually would have been kind of interesting to see that Charlie cut his hand. But of course that's, I would imagine if something like that had happened to you, your first instinct would be to get out of camera range because that's what wasn't supposed to happen.
Well, I think that's also, you know, a tribute to Wells' history on the stage. And I think as a theater actor, like you really do roll with accidents like that and incorporate them in some way. So, I mean, that was probably a knee-jerk decision that he made.
Now, I doubt you've ever cut yourself or anything, but have you ever had something while you were in the middle of a scene where that was completely unexpected and you were like, whoa, okay.
It's funny you mention it. When I was a teenager, I was in a production of the Agatha Christie play, And Then There Were None.
Okay.
And I was playing Vera Claythorne. Vera Claythorne.
Names. That's a great Agatha Christie name.
Yeah. And, so in the play, I mean, this is a spoiler alert for people that aren't familiar with Agatha Christie. The members of this island, they've all been invited to this island and they're systematically dying one by one. And Vera Claythorne is the last one standing and she finds herself alone in the room with the murderer, who's not who she expected. And she's alone and it's very frightening. And a sort of a chase scene ensues on stage with, you know, him trying to, you know, knock her out. And the actor was a friend of mine and we'd gone through the choreography and, you know, everyone knew what they were doing. And he was supposed to, you know, pretend to attack me and then I would fall in terror to the ground before my heroic savior burst into the room. And we did the choreography and I don't blame the other actor for this. I'm not quite sure how it happened, but the idea was I would fall behind the couch and then bounce back up in a few minutes when my rescuer appeared. And again, I'm not sure what happened, but I fell and somehow I hit my head on the lip of the stage and I was just out. I completely was out behind the couch. And as it was described to me later, you know, so then the murderer's there and my hero comes into the room and they're both sort of just looking at each other, confused and perplexed because they don't know if like this changes the whole nature of the plot. Like did I survive? Is she okay? Like what happened? I was okay. I mean, it took me a few minutes to recover, but I mean, that must've been some really awkward, ad-libbing for the other, performers. But Agatha Christie was very real to me in that moment. I mean, that I think that was probably one of my greatest performances, actually. You know, I was really method. Convincing, really convincing. So I can relate to the being cut. Yeah.
Wow. Did you have any hesitation to do it the next day? I mean, you had to do that fall again?
Well, you know, I'm a real professional, you know, I'm a real, and I mean, these things, you know, accidents, I mean, that's the other, you know, with Orson Welles, I mean, that's sort of something that happens in theater that doesn't happen in filmmaking is, you know, on stage, you have to incorporate accidents into the performance because the show can't stop unless it's a real emergency. But I would just say, you know, fight choreography is hugely important.
Yeah, I imagine these actors having to vamp while they're just looking to see if you're.
Yeah, dead. Yeah, like oh, funny to see you here. You know, yeah. Is that, what brings you here?
It's we're improving on the Agatha Christie text here. We're
right, adding exactly. Our lines. Method, yeah.
Method, yeah. So okay. So we have Charlie wandering, and then he staggers kind of back into the frame, and then we get a close up of him holding the. You know, the snow globe, which of course we saw at the beginning of the film. And then we pan up to him and he is teary eyed and he just says Rosebud. And then we see that his butler played by Ray Stewart and played by Paul Stewart is watching him. And we see from that shot behind the butler, how many people work at Xanadu. I mean, he has got, a small army of people, none of whom you presume that he communicates with, and you see how lonely Susan is, and yet, you know, my God, he looks like he has 50 people on staff. It's just absurd.
Absolutely. And it's, you know, it's an interesting scene to examine, and I'm really, you know, so happy that I was assigned this for our talk today, because apparently I was reading, you know, some interviews with members of the cast and people that had witnessed this particular performance, and William Allen, who stars in the film, and he was also one of the actors from the Mercury Theater. Sure. He gave a really fascinating interview on this scene in particular. And he said that Orson Welles had never really liked himself as an actor, and that Orson Welles had this idea that he should have been feeling more, and that he intellectualized the character too much, and that it was hard for Orson to like completely lose himself in a part as much as would be required for that sort of shock and awe in the scene. And of course, when you see it, like, it is still very resonant and very, you know, disturbing. And it seems like a man, you know, who's totally lost everything, and he's like unhinged at that point. But William Allen said that, like, for that furniture breaking scene, Orson Welles set up 4 cameras because he didn't want to do the scene more than twice. And so it's interesting also, like what you're saying with the cut on his hand, like he only did the scene twice. And I don't know if that's because of, like, you know, the emotional depth that he was required to go to. I mean, it was probably, you know, no little expense to like completely redecorate the room every time. But I think that scene really was like, I think Welles was very anxious about performing it because he didn't consider himself having that, like, you know, Dionysian, you know, sort of like unbridled emotion that an actor would be required to perform in that scene. And so I think it really weighed heavily on him. And I also heard an interesting account that Herman Mankiewicz had wanted to put a scene like that in the screenplay, because when he was working on the screenplay, it was around the time that Orson Welles' first wife, Virginia, had filed for divorce. And so in Orson Welles' like own personal life, this idea of having just lost his wife was very, very fresh in his mind and very fresh in his emotional life. And there's an account that Mankiewicz had witnessed like a similar sort of tantrum from Orson Welles, and that they wanted him to create that as Cain.
Everything's, which is Christopher, like, the mill.
I mean, but it's like, it's such a sadistic thing to, it's like if your friend is going through this like horrible divorce and they're like, great, love it, like, let's use that, you know, like, can you do it again, you know? So it's sadistic if true, but it is true that Welles was nervous about performing that scene. But I was, you know, when William Allen talks about it, he said like the energy in the room was absolutely like electric. Mm. And that, you know, he had seemed, you know, totally undone. And like with most great performances, like I think those kinds of emotional depths like do drive you to the brink of sanity.
Yeah, I mean, so when Welles leaves the room, when Charlie Kane leaves the room and everyone is staring at him, and he has this sort of glassy-eyed stare, and he puts the snow globe in his pocket, but he looks like he doesn't even really see that these people are there. He's so kind of looks sort of monomaniacal. He's just, and he's sort of lumbering out of the room. One of the other things I noticed when watching this scene is that we see, you know, the doorway as he walks out, and then around the doorway is this framing. And, you know, I don't know much about architecture, but it looks as though that none of these architectural elements match any other architectural elements. And it's like, this is like what a person with not necessarily a whole lot of taste, but a lot of money puts together. Because none of it, it's just thrown together. Like, it doesn't look like any of it really is cohesively designed. But that's what happens when you have all the money in the world. You tell somebody, I want a vaguely sort of like Arabic looking frame over this Art Deco door. And those two things may not match, but nobody's going to turn you down because you're paying them to do it.
That's a great observation. Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, and it's one of the rare times we get to see the door, any sort of doorway like that as Kane stumbles out. And we see there's a second doorway just like that. And then he sort of wanders out, and you know, we see that everyone's just sort of following him. And then we get this one brief glimpse of him reflected in a mirror. Mm-hmm. And then that is going to lead to one of the most famous shots, maybe in all of cinema, certainly of this movie, is where he is reflected back at himself, like a hall of mirrors. Mm-hmm. And we see something like 8 or 9 versions of Charlie Kane. Mm-hmm. And it's, on the one hand, it's a show-off shot. It's Orson Welles showing off a little, like, hey, look at this. Part of the reason I love the movie is that it has that charm to it. As you mentioned, he has that kind of childlike, like, look what we can do. Look at this shot. Look how cool this is. But at the same time, you're like, well, okay, thematically it does fit in that this whole movie has been multiple people's versions of this character. Mm-hmm. And that's just being reflected back at us, that which one is the real guy? We don't mm-hmm. know. Nobody, and he doesn't even know at this point.
Well, and I like that you point out like the garishness of the architecture, because that transition, you know, coming out of the archway and then past the Hall of Mirrors reminds me so much of the Lady from Shanghai, you know, and it's, I mean, obviously like in the mirrors themselves, but I think also like in so many ways, I feel that Citizen Kane isn't so much a biography of William Randolph Hearst or any of the other, you know, various tycoons that it's based on. I really feel that it's the autobiography of Orson Welles. And I feel that, like, you know, as an actor and really truly like as a shapeshifter, like here he is like a 25-year-old man playing this world-weary, embittered, haggard, like just complete shell of a human being. And we see him change shape so many times in the film that I think mirrors were a very important symbol for him. And I think this question of like, you know, we've seen Charles Foster Kane reflected through the eyes of the people that know him. And we've seen Orson Welles in these various costumes and disguises, but what's the heart of this person? What is the heart? And what is the heart of Charles Foster Kane? Is it Rosebud? What's Orson Welles' Rosebud? And there's this same, like, for all the grandeur and the hugeness of the architecture and the space, there's something so existentially lonely about that shot.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's all this guy has now at this point is his own reflection looking back at him. He has nobody else in his life. We saw in a previous scene a little while ago that, you know, where Jed mentions that, that Charlie wrote to him and he didn't write back. And so now Susan's walked out on him, and now, and you know, that kind of uneven underscoring what you're saying, as the camera stays in place, as Charlie Kane walks out of the frame, and we are just, and we even zoom in a little bit on the empty mirrors. And I mean, to me, that's obviously a very conscious choice, that to not cut just as he leaves the frame, but to hold for like, you know, 1, 2, 3 Mississippi, as we're just looking at these empty mirrors. Cause it's like, yeah, that's, there's this guy doesn't have anything anymore. And he has no center. He has no idea at this age. He still has no idea who he is or what he's about. And it's all just sort of these empty husks that mm-hmm. we're seeing. And it's as much as you are not sympathetic towards Charlie Kane, because he is kind of a rotten person and he's really gone astray. At the same time, you know, we saw his origins and you can't help but have some sympathy for him, because mm-hmm. it was almost like he was never given a chance. I mean, he was raised by a banker, for Pete's sakes. I mean, he was taken away from the one person that really loved him, his mother. And he never, in some ways, he never really had a chance in some respect.
Right. And, you know, to that point of Citizen Kane potentially being an autobiography by and for Orson Welles, I think there's also something very symbolic in that hugeness of that house itself. And for all its grandeur and, you know, massive elegance, I feel like it's a metaphor for what Welles was experiencing in his own life at that time, where he really had the world at his feet. And, you know, he didn't agree to the RKO contract until he was given complete creative control of the film, which is unheard of for a first-time director. And I wonder if, like, at 25 years old, you know, helming your own movie like this, it probably in some ways was a very lonely time as well. Like, really, where can you go from there. And I think, you know, the way that we see that play out in the rest of Orson Welles' life and career is like this particular segment from the breaking the furniture in Susan's room to that walk past the Hall of Mirrors. It really seems almost like an eerie, like self-fulfilling prophecy for Orson Welles, where he's created this massive, you know, career for himself, this massive home, this massive house for himself, and he destroys it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not giving him what he wants. He has everything in the world except this, you know, he's still empty. And for that, it's so moving to me. I was thinking about that, and it's so true with, like, it's so tragic, like, you know, with the rest of his life and the, you know, various tragedies and difficulties he encountered. That whole segment seems very prophetic.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, said it sounds great being called a boy genius, but probably not. It probably is pretty lonely. You know, if everyone is thinking you're this great genius and you're like respected to deliver constantly. And of course he does here, but I mean, that's, again, that's a lot of pressure to put on yourself. So after that, we go back to Paul Stewart talking to Mr. Thompson, and he mentions Rosebud, and he says, yeah, he said it that one other time before he died. And so, okay, it does seem to suggest that the butler, in fact, was in the room when he says Rosebud at the beginning of the film. Now, that opening shot, that seems to cut against that, because it seems like when the nurse enters, that's the only person that is in the room after he dies. We never see the butler, but here he is expressly saying, I was in the room when he said it. So, okay, maybe the butler's lying. Maybe he isn't. Obviously, the butler here knows that the sell-by date for the Charlie Kane story is rapidly approaching, because he's desperate to get the $1,000 out of Mr. Thompson. And Mr. Thompson even says, that's not worth $1,000. He goes, oh, I could tell you other stuff. So he's like, he's desperate to extract $1,000 out of this guy, because he knows once Mr. Thompson leaves, nobody's really going to care. And it's a great performance by Paul Stewart, because he's just so oily and just sleazy. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. Truly. It's a little bit of a film noir moment in that particular scene. I think, you know, somebody asks him if he's sentimental, and he says, yes and no.
Yeah, yes and no. he's so good in this movie. I just, he only has that one scene, but man, he's just terrific. So then we see Mr. Thompson, and he's there with some of his crew, and different people are packing up all the various bric-a-brac in Xanadu. There's a great composite shot. Again, you know, Citizen Kane is so full of special effects, but they're invisible special effects. They're not Star Wars special effects, which are obvious. And so you have this shot of Mr. Thompson talking to somebody up on a ladder. And they're on a next level of Xanadu, and they're probably like 50 feet in the air. Mm-hmm. And we hear them, you know, talk kind of far away like that as they're asking something. And of course, these are two shots stitched together. It makes it look like it's all one shot, that he is in this great hall, but you can almost see where they would cut the film to splice it together. And again, it's a marvelous how much Kane, I keep switching the names, Wells, and his people were able to fool the eye into making you think you were seeing this grand epic when you really weren't, because this was just two pieces of film that they stitched together, but it looks seamless.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And it's so haunting in a way, like seeing all the statues wrapped up to be moved and just the crates and crates of stuff. And you really just, I get the chills when I see that, because you just, it's such like a cold perspective on like the empty and hollow materialism that he's, you know, like, it's just these, like, it almost feels like, you know, the circus is packing up and leaving town. You know, it feels very theatrical in a way. Like, it feels like, you know, like Shakespeare, like our revels here are ended, you know, it's like closing time. It's just, it's so haunting. And you just, it's like sawdust and tinsel. It's like, you know, this whole illusion of Xanadu is just like a bunch of crates and statues. It's like haunting.
We have this pan across a bunch of statues, and we hear one reporter, and all these people are draped in shadow virtually. We don't really see anybody's faces, but we have one guy talking about that, the one statue was like $10,000, and he goes, that's a lot of money to pay for a dame without a head. And that always gets a laugh. When I saw it in the theater, that line got a laugh. And it's sort of funny. It's like, I don't know if I don't know if you feel the same way about Greer, but like we all, you know, we all know what's coming to us mm-hmm. at some point down the line. And mm-hmm. we all have bric-a-brac that mm-hmm. we have accumulated in our lives. And yeah. we hope that we will have loved ones and friends and family that will go through the stuff that we leave behind and treat it with respect. But this is scary because, mm-hmm. you know, the worst part is would be to have a bunch of people coming in and kind of making fun of it, right. mocking it. And that feels, it feels as much as, again, you know, Charlie Kane is not necessarily the most sympathetic figure. You do feel sorry for him because they are mm-hmm. kind of mocking him. They're making fun of him. And we even see later on, you know, not everything was just meant to be purchased because it was valuable. They even point out that there was a stove from his mother. And we see that it's an old timey, you know, wood burning stove, but he kept that.
Hoarders.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't just, we see the cup, you know, the newspaper men got him the cup, the stenciled cup, but he even kept a worthless stove, and they even say, what's it worth? Like 37 cents or whatever it is. But there is something, it feels very just kind of offensive to see all these people kind of chuckle at this guy's life. And you see the one female reporter say, oh, I got a puzzle. Oh, we got lots of those. And it's just, you feel like you shouldn't be here to see this. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I know this stuff, when anything is accumulated at this volume, it loses all of its meaning because, of course, mm-hmm. if everything is special, nothing is special. But it mm-hmm. just you all of a sudden have so much more sympathy for Charlie Kane watching all these people just kind of make fun of the guy.
Well, and to the point and connection with William Randolph Hearst, I mean, I feel like there's something that is very alluring but also uncomfortable about, you know, visiting Hearst Castle, where it's become a tourist attraction, and like that point where like the private becomes public. You know, you're right. Is this meant to be seen? And is it meant to be seen in this sort of context of entertainment? And when they're just haphazardly throwing it into the fireplace, you know, I think it's also a testament to, you know, Kane's obsession with creating his own legacy throughout. And, you know, it all ends up in a bartering over how much a stove costs. It's pretty tragic.
I've always been I don't have the collector bug. I used to, but I don't have it anymore. And so I have relatively few possessions. I mean, I have, you know, the same number of possessions most people have that have a home, because you have all the, you know, all that stuff. But in terms of like collecting stuff or books, I don't have that much. And mm-hmm. so I always wondered, I saw this movie again at a very impressionable age. I was a teenager. I have to wonder if this wasn't one of the things that dug itself into my brain of like, don't leave a lot of stuff behind.
It's true.
Because someone's going to have to go through it all. And most of it's probably going to get chucked in the trash because it doesn't mean anything to anybody. I mean, I have some comic books that are in rotten condition because they've been read 40 million times because they're so beloved to me. They're not worth anything. And I wonder if I outlive all my, it's getting dark this episode, but if I outlive all my friends, whoever gets through that, they'll just look at them and be like, what is this garbage? And out into the trash it goes. And that's okay because the thing had a good life, but they'll never know how much this seemingly worthless item meant to me. You know, and they don't know why he kept his mother's stove. We know why he kept the mother's stove, but to these people, it just doesn't matter. And speaking of the reporters that are all here, and by they're all draped in shadow, as I said, it's amazing. We see one guy, his silhouette pops more than the rest because he's got a pipe sticking out of his mouth. You can't help but see it. And that, of course, is not of course, but that is Alan Ladd, who would go on to become a major star and a lot of great film noirs. But this was an early role for him. And I mean, he was just a jobbing actor at that point. And you really don't even see his face except for one brief second. And unless you know to look for it, you wouldn't even know it. But there's, you know, that's Alan Ladd, you know, putting time in in Citizen Kane. It's pretty amazing. Mm-hmm.
Right. Absolutely. That's definitely an argument for Citizen Kane is a film noir. absolutely. And I think what you're, you know, this conversation about, well, it's really, you know, Wells' perspective on materialism and like grandeur. Like, I think Wells had lived his life in such a way that it was really easy come, easy go for him. Like, you know, he tells these stories about, you know, being a young boy and basically just having a trunk of items. And I think that that's partially why he was so invested in, you know, magic and theater, because, you know, you create something from nothing. And I know we're probably running the clock here, but I just have a
It's a podcast. It goes as long as we want it to go.
A fireside chat. there's one story. I was watching this interview with Orson Welles, and he was telling a story, and it's really stuck in my mind as a great companion story for Citizen Kane. And I think it really demonstrates, you know, his feelings on it. But Orson Welles talks about being a young man, like a teenager, and he went with his father to visit his aunt who was living in New York, and she lived in this huge mansion. And this seems very like Magnificent Ambersons to me. Like, she lives in this, you know, big house, but stays inside all the time, and she doesn't realize that like the world has like passed her by and like the world is changing. So there's like this image of like this derelict grandeur, which that's so gothic. And I think it really comes out in these like, you know, last scenes of the film. But he goes to visit his aunt, and they're all sitting in the parlor on chairs. And at one point, Orson Welles gets up to go to the bathroom. And he goes in the bathroom, and he sees the bathtub is filled with empty ginger ale bottles. Hundreds. I mean, if Orson's telling this story, it's like hundreds of empty ginger ale bottles. And he goes, he's like, you know, I wonder what that is. And he goes back out, and he sits down on the chair, and he's, you know, with his aunt and his dad. And he asks his aunt, so, you know, what's the deal with all the ginger ale bottles? And she says, like, totally deadpan, champagne is too expensive now, so I use ginger ale instead. And so his aunt can't afford to take champagne baths anymore, so she takes ginger ale baths. And I just think that says so much, that it's like, in a way, it's like, it's funny, but it's also so sad and so dark at the same time, that it's like, you know, this elegant idea of like decadence, like to take a bath in champagne, has been replaced by the next best thing. Like, we're not going to have champagne, but we will have, you know, a ginger ale bath. And I think Orson like loved that sort of thing, where it's like, it's almost not so much like the quality of the object as like what it represents. Like, as long as you're taking a bath in a bubbly liquid, you know, it's like that derelict, like, you know, Pauline Kael called Citizen Kane a gothic comedy. And I think there's also an argument for that. So we have a few different genres in the running here. Yeah.
I love that she didn't lie, that she just straight up told them what it was. She could have said something else, but
right,
I love that
exactly.
She was honest with them about it.
Right. And I think, you know, there's a little, I'm imagining this is played by Agnes Moorehead, you know, in my mind. But I think that she wasn't ashamed of it. And it was just sort of practical. It was like, well, you know, I can't afford champagne. And, you know, God bless her for doing it regardless.
I have to think that idea stuck in Orson's head. I call him Orson. I hear him on a first name basis with Orson.
Oh, Wells, yeah.
But stuck in his head, because you think about the kind of compromises he had to make to get his films made, where, like, you know, he didn't have the money to finish Macbeth.
Right.
And, or no, not Macbeth. He did that for Republic. What was the other one? Not Othello. He did the other. I'm blanking on which one he did. But there's one where all the costumes did not arrive for this scene. And so they just shot it in a bathhouse, and they threw everybody in towels from the hotel.
Yeah.
And they're scene's in a bathhouse now. And you're like, that's the same idea as taking a ginger ale bath.
It's like, use what you have, you know. It's like, invent, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. And that reminds me, I don't know if it's Othello, but I just also want to remind our listeners that Orson Welles starred in a production with Eartha Kitt, who he was also dating at the time. So in your research, there's some very interesting photos of Eartha Kitt and Orson Welles together. And I know this is a tangent, but Orson Welles called Eartha Kitt the sexiest woman alive. So at least he knew what he was. And I mean, that's after Rita Hayworth. So, you know, I mean, Eartha Kitt, Eartha Kitt and Orson Welles together. I mean, the mind boggles.
It sure does. What were those dinner conversations like? Holy Mac.
There was probably a lot of growling and, like, you know, hissing. I don't know. I don't even think they probably were talking. It's just so, like, you know, there's a lot of energy between those two. I think it's very,
wow.
Yeah.
Oh man. So I got to pause here to think about that. So, during the final minute of the sequence, we see that the reporters are talking, and one of the female reporters hands the puzzle to Mr. Thompson, and he kind of just, like, puts the pieces back, and they start talking about Rosebud. And that, well, you know, what was it? Well, it was a dame that he met, or it was something. And they said, and then someone says, well, if we knew what Rosebud was, it would probably explain everything. And then you've literally got Mr. Thompson undercutting that whole thing. He's undercutting the whole movie by saying, no, I don't think so. I don't think any one word can signify a man's life, can sum up a man's life. And it's so funny because I have seen criticisms of Citizen Kane by people that say, oh, it's the sled. So what? Like, I waited 2 hours to find out it's the sled. And it's a sled. Yeah, it is. But that's not really the point. In fact, you've literally got a scene where you've got our main character in a lot of ways saying, no, it doesn't matter. You're about to find out what the sled is, what the Rosebud is, but it doesn't really matter because that's not what this is about. And so it's like, good Lord, Welles couldn't be explaining it for you more clearly when he has a character say it. No, it really doesn't matter. It can't sum up a man's life with one word.
It's interesting. That's like the enduring mystery of the film, though. You know, it's I think it's also such a provocative word, because Rosebud to me is also like, it's such an innocent image of like something before it's blossomed, and like there's something so, you know, sort of youthful and naive about it, that I think the beauty of the word itself is very appealing as well.
Yes, it's a pretty word. It's a pretty word. It conjures up a nice image. Of course, we know what supposedly that it was from William Randolph Hearst's nickname for the favorite part of Marion Davies' Anatomy. So imagine learning that Herman Mankiewicz knew that and put that in the script. Like, gee, thanks, Herman. That's a, you know. So the final couple of seconds of these 5 minutes is that we're going to get a further and further pan back of all of the stuff. And, you know, it can't help remind one of the final matte painting in Raiders of the Lost Ark, where they put the ark in the car and you see this thing. And once again, it's the far away shot is amazing, because you see literally hundreds of boxes all piled up, and there's no order to any of it. There's no pads that look like that have been made. It's just stuff accumulated. And it's an impressive shot, because you're like, my God, the warehouse that they shot, the stage they shot this in, was just filled to the brim with this stuff. But you also realize it's probably very economical, because other than a couple of items that you see a headboard, you see a couple of statues, you see the cup, stuff that we've seen throughout the film. Most of it is just random junk. So it was probably stuff just pulled from various RKO offices.
Yeah, Cecil B. DeMille antiques.
Yeah, you know, I mean,
Norma Desmond.
Yeah, it's all just random stuff that probably was either borrowed for the shot or grabbed from the prop department, of just crates and stuff. And that's where these 5 minutes are going to end, is this slow pan over all of this stuff. And of course, you're leaving and think, well, we're headed somewhere, but that's where the 5 minutes is going to end, is just all of this stuff, all of the stuff piled up, accumulated. And it's, again, like I said, it's for a film that we know was not expensive. It was not a high-budgeted picture. Again, Welles really gives you this sense of some huge story being told. And again, it's one of his great, and you said he's a magician. One of his great tricks is making this film seem like it's Gone with the Wind. It's Lawrence of Arabia, when it was probably a 20th of that budget.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think it's so profound, too, in a way that, you know, it like takes on this subject of like the great American myth, and yet it's just such a the futility of it at the end, like this empty, hollow stuff upon stuff upon stuff in this cavernous space. It's a very existential, you know, sensation. It's, yeah.
It's really, really, it's really, really startling. And I said, and so now at this point, we've only got the last 5 minutes of the film. So that is going to wrap up these 5 minutes of Citizen Kane. So Greer, before we sign off, is there anything else you want to say about Citizen Kane before we say goodbye here?
Well, I had so much fun. We covered so much ground here today. I mean, I don't think this is the last word on Citizen Kane by any stretch of the imagination.
Probably not,
I mean,
no.
I think it really has lodged itself in the mind of audiences, you know, and I think it will always continue to. So I feel like in a way, like some of the mysteries in Citizen Kane, I think are asking not to be solved. I don't think it's a movie that wants to be solved or even figured out. And I think that ambiguity and curiosity is what keeps it alive. So on that note, I won't aspire to solve the film, but I've really enjoyed talking about it with you today and looking forward to rewatching it and putting some of my stuff in the furnace.
Yeah, I'm all of a sudden looking at my stuff
really,
over here.
I'm like,
I think I have too many things. I think I still have too many. Get rid of that. Yeah, I don't need that. I could sell that back to a bookstore or something.
Right. So, I'm going to take a ginger ale bath tonight.
That's
there we go. As a tribute. Yeah.
There you go. It's a real Miss Havisham energy.
Totally.
Bath. So, well, Greer, thank you so much for doing this. I very much appreciate it. Like I said, I was really fascinated with the idea of talking to an actor because that's the kind of thing that's just, I mean, I, you know, these podcasts are performances to a certain extent, but I have the safety of the no camera. I'm just behind a microphone, and that gives me that kind of security that I've got. That's my no trespassing sign. So I find anyone that can get on a stage and perform like that to be incredibly brave people. I don't know how you do it, but you do it. Thankfully, for all the rest of us to be entertained by. So. Thank you so much for coming by. I very much appreciate it. Why don't you tell people where they can find you out on the internet?
So for our audiences, again, my name is Greer Sinclair, and I'm lurking in a few different places online. My writing is available on my website, www.greersinclair.com. And my other projects, I have some exciting things to be announced shortly. And I mean, I won't say that my Twitter is exemplary, but I'm usually watching some pretty interesting bee pictures and talking about them there. And otherwise I can be seen in some local Los Angeles historic haunts from time to time, but you have to catch me at the right time. So I hope to see you all around, and thanks again for having me. It was so fun to be here.
Oh, well, thank you very much. So, of course, everybody, you can find back episodes of this show over on our website, finewaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to Citizen Kane Minute on any podcatcher of your choice. We are on Twitter as well, over at C Kane Minute. And then finally, if you want to support the Fire and Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW Podcast, and there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on the show of your choice. So big thanks to Slick for their support of Citizen Kane Minute. I very much appreciate it. So that's going to do it, everybody. Come back next week for the final 5 minutes of Citizen Kane here on Citizen Kane Minute.
What's the real truth about Charles Foster Kane? I wish you'd come to this theater when Citizen Kane plays here and decide for yourself.